Welcome to the Derbyshire CCG's latest podcast. We're very pleased to have Ady Cooper speaking on making safeguarding personal. So without further ado, over to you, Ady. We'd like you to give us a little bit of background about yourself.
Thank you, Ed. So at the moment, I chair three safeguarding adult boards in London. I'm also working for the Local Government Association Care and Health Improvement Programme. I'm the safeguarding lead and the regional lead for London. And I still co-chair the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, Adult Safeguarding Policy Network. And I've been involved with MSP, really, making safeguarding personal right from the start. So I'm going to talk about what it is, why we started doing it, and how it's developed over time, and a bit about what it means for practice. So basically, what is making safeguarding personal? It's what making safeguarding personal means is that the way that we undertake anything with adults around safeguarding is person-led, so it's led by the person, it's outcome-focused, it's focused on what we're wanting to achieve, what they're wanting to achieve. It enhances their involvement and choice and control, and it is there to improve quality of life as well as well-being and safety. So it's really about a change in a culture and practice or an approach to safeguarding adults rather than a set of policies and procedures. And it's also now in the Care Act statutory guidance. So one of the short ways of thinking about this is referring back to Justice Mumby's quote about what good is it making someone safer if it merely makes them miserable. So we've got to always keep in mind that what we're trying to do with safeguarding is both ensure that people are safe, but also that their well-being is promoted. So this is a real shift to how we were doing, how we were practicing adult safeguarding in the past. So I'd say, looking back into the noughties, into the early part of the 21st century, after No Secrets, what we started to see, and particularly around, for example, the consultation on No Secrets, which was background to the Care Act introduction, was that how we were undertaking our safeguarding adult activity, people were saying to us that they weren't really feeling listened to and being supported to make choices in their life. People didn't particularly see that the safeguarding processes brought positive resolution to the circumstances they were in. They were often wanting to be safe, but also wanting other aspects of their life to be enhanced. So the classic is, how do you cope with and how do you support somebody who may be the only person they see in terms of their social isolation and their links into the outside world is actually the person who is abusing them? And how do you manage to support them both to be safe but also not to lose any human contact? People were telling us they wanted to make their own choices. They wanted to be able to weigh up risks and benefits of different courses of action rather than be told what to do by professionals. And I think we were also very driven to look on the abuse itself, i.e. whether or not it was substantiated or not, which is the language of the performance framework that we were using, rather than on what were the outcomes that people wanted from the safeguarding investigations they were talked about at that described about in that time. For example, developing self-confidence to manage the risks in their life, making complaints or stopping the abuse, for example. And these messages were then also reinforced by work that was done through the Local Government Association around peer reviews, which is when a group of officers and partners go into another local authority and look at adult safeguarding functions and try and help in terms of identifying areas for improvement. And I'm quoting from a publication that the LGA produced that described some of the feedback from peer reviews in, this is in June 2013. Direct quote was, it probably is fair to say that the emphasis of safeguarding activity so far has been on investigation and conclusions rather than improving outcomes. This has been strongly affected by the fact that national reporting had focused on this. Although outcomes are recorded, they're in reality outputs rather than outcomes, and they were often increased monitoring or increased services. So what we were finding is that what was happening as a result of an output from safeguarding intervention was more intervention in people's lives rather than maybe support for people to keep themselves safe. And this was driven to some extent by the way in which performance information was being collected. The focus was on investigating whether or not the abuse had happened rather than talking to and listening to the person themselves about what they might want to happen. So another direct quote was, "Peer challenges highlight that people tend not to be asked the outcomes they want. Often they want more than one outcome, which is sometimes not easy to reconcile. People generally want to feel safe, but also maintain relationships. For example, for some people, the only human contact they have is with the person or the people who are harming or abusing them," which reinforces my earlier point about complexity in terms of safeguarding adult activity. And I think if we think back to that time around Winterbourne View, the Francis Report on Mid-Staffordshire, Ombudsman's reports and so on, what we have is a kind of very consistent messages coming back again and again around how people want to be treated and involved in the work that is about them, how people want to be listened to, and how important it is that we work with them in terms of risk and risk management, and also support staff to change an attitude and culture to this area of work so that the emphasis is looking at the impact on people's lives and working with them to resolve the problems in their lives rather than seeing safeguarding adults as a process that involves ticking boxes and holding meetings and getting professionals to talk to each other, that actually this is about talking with and listening to people who are directly affected and subject to harm or risk of harm, abuse or neglect. So the work that we started on making safeguarding personal originates in about 2009. We first of all looked for a literature review because we wanted to see what was there in terms of what works. And what we found was there was very little in the research that told us what was effective in adult safeguarding. So in response to that, we started a sort of, what could you call it, a kind of test bed. We looked at trying out a few things. Some councils, half a dozen councils, volunteered to try out various different things in terms of safeguarding adults, including things like family group conferencing and restorative justice. So looking at very different approaches to how we work with safeguarding adults, and we produced a toolkit of responses borrowed from various other areas of work that we thought might be useful in terms of learning how we might work better to help people achieve recovery and resolution in their lives when they were at risk of abuse or neglect. The piloting then snowballed, and in 2013-14 we had 53 local authorities participating in piloting a different approach to adult safeguarding practice, and then that was mainstreamed as the Care Act came in 2014-15. And subsequent to that, we've had various documents, reports, guides, for example, on domestic abuse and adult safeguarding, evaluating the programme, reviewing how it's working, progressing on implementation to learn from what was happening around the country to inform people who are making safeguarding personal forward within their own areas. I think it's worth pausing at 2006. We did what we called a temperature check, where we interviewed 76% of local authorities about how they were getting on with making safeguarding personal, and what were the sort of blocks and barriers, what were the facilitators and the things that helped take it forward. And as a result of that report, there were some recommendations which I've been able to take through the LGA CHIP program in terms of delivering some of the things that people wanted help with. For example, translating what making safeguarding personal was for partner agencies like health, housing, the police, so that the language, because we use a very particular language in our own field, is something that then can be understood by our partners, because as we know, safeguarding adults is a partnership endeavour. It's not something anyone does in isolation. And we're also now working on areas like working with risk, looking at the thresholds for Section 42 inquiries, and so on and so forth. So it's an ongoing work stream looking at what people wanted from a national support for making safeguarding personal to progress locally. I'll just refer to something that Professor Jill Manthorpe told me quite a while back, because I'd say now we're about 8 or 9 years through this work on making safeguarding personal. She says it takes 17 years to change culture and practice. I don't know where she got that from, but I did ask her recently and she said, yes, AD, 17 years is the average time it takes to change things. And so I think, well, we're on a journey that we're maybe halfway through trying to shift the way in which we operate and deliver our adult safeguarding work with the people we're working with. But I did talk about this at a event with some mental health service users looking at hate crime and safeguarding in that area of experience. And they said to me, but AD, we can't wait 17 years. This has to happen now. So when I talk to people about making safeguarding personal, I tell them that story, partly to say, you know, we don't achieve culture change overnight. So, you know, we should have realistic expectations. But for the people who we work with, they want this to happen yesterday. Sure. And so we mustn't forget that. And we need to constantly be thinking about what we're doing from the perspective of the people who we're working for and with. So moving on to making safeguarding personal in the Care Act. So when we started the work on making safeguarding personal way back in 2009, we were promoting it as good practice, that this is something that people could do, that was something that would improve the effectiveness, we hypothesized, of our adult safeguarding support and intervention. But with the Care Act, making safeguarding personal has become part of the statutory guidance, so it's now what we must do, what we should do, not what we just can do for good practice. And I think, you know, we started off not really knowing that that would happen in this journey, but obviously it adds an extra weight in terms of promoting making safeguarding sure. personal to say this is something that we need to be doing. And I'll cite the actual definition in the statutory guidance of what safeguarding is, because I think making safeguarding personal is absolutely reflected in that. So the core definition of safeguarding is that people and organisations working together to prevent and stop both the risks and experience of abuse or neglect, while at the same time making sure that the adult's well-being is promoted, including, where appropriate, having regard to their views, wishes, feelings and beliefs in deciding on any action. So that piece about having regard to views, wishes and feelings and beliefs, how can you do that if you don't talk with and listen to the people who we're working with? So I would argue that making safeguarding personal is absolutely threaded through the safeguarding adult guidance. It's there in the six principles: empowerment, prevention, proportionality, protection, partnership and accountability. Most people would say, yes, of course, empowerment is making safeguarding personal. But I would argue it's there throughout all of the principles, and it's actually translated in the guidance into I statements, so statements on behalf of the service users themselves, which I would say is absolutely indicative of a personalised outcome-focused approach, that what we do, even as at the level of principle, is we need to translate into what does that mean for the person themselves. So moving on to the way that making safeguarding personal is threaded through the statutory guidance. I'll quote from some of the guidance itself. So first of all, the adult should be involved at the beginning of an inquiry and their views and wishes ascertained. So we need to, right from the start, I would argue even at the start when a concern is raised, we should be asking the person what their views are. I unfortunately get called into work in areas where people are struggling with safeguarding adults, and I still come across places where people will say to me, oh, we went out to talk to someone about a safeguarding concern and they didn't know that anybody had raised it. And I find that that's, for me, a bit of a kind of red flag that if people don't even know that somebody has raised a concern about them, then it becomes very difficult to work with them, because you're then having to go right back to, well, what is the concern? Are they concerned, or is it a professional concern? And all of those things, of course. Sure. Obviously, there are complexities when people don't want issues referred and concerns raised, and there are issues around public safety or duties of care. So I'm not saying that it's 100% as a science, but that engagement with people at the beginning of an inquiry, I would say right at the beginning of when a concern is raised, for me, is absolutely critical to get their views, even if their views are, like we would find maybe with people who self-neglect and hoard, that they don't want our intervention in their lives. Sure. It doesn't mean we walk away, and I'll come to that later. So that's in the Care Act guidance. I think the next bit of guidance I would refer to is that the wishes of an adult who lacks mental capacity are of equal importance to someone with mental capacity. And this has been an issue that has been raised right from the beginning of Making Safeguarding Personal. So when we were piloting Making Safeguarding Personal, people would say, well, it's all very well, AD, we can do this, we can take this approach with people with mental capacity, but we can't really do it if someone's got dementia, can we? How can we find out what their views and wishes are? Well, actually, apart from, I think it probably breaches equalities legislation and duties, and the Mental Capacity Act, we do know now, and we should know, that working with people who lack mental capacity, there are ways of means to find out what they might have or would have wanted. So it's not an excuse. And the Care Act actually says very clearly, the guidance, that actually the wishes of someone who lacks mental capacity are of equal importance, i.e. we have a duty to find out what those wishes would be. So we ask their friends, their family, their loved ones, the people who know them best, well, what would this person have wanted? Would they have been able to express it? And I think that's really, really important. And I would argue that mental capacity and understanding mental capacity, particularly in relationship to risk, is absolutely fundamental to Making Safeguarding Personal, and it's core to all safeguarding activity. Another quote from the guidance is that people have complex lives, and being safe is only one thing they want for themselves. Professionals should work with the adult to establish what being safe means to them and how this can best be achieved. And so I would go back to the fundamental core principles of the Care Act around well-being, that well-being and safety both need to be addressed in any safeguarding activity. And what does being safe mean to somebody is absolutely critical in terms of informing our practice and what we do around supporting them in that, as well as what they want for themselves in terms of their well-being. And then finally, in terms of Care Act guidance, I think we've got the reference to safeguarding planning, which need to involve joint discussion, decision-making, and planning with the adult for their future safety and well-being. So when we're looking at how we plan to support someone to keep safe in their lives or to eliminate or reduce the risks of abuse and neglect, we have to do it with the person. It has to be a joint discussion. It's got to be planned with that adult. And I think that's where we are most likely to get the more productive and successful outcomes in terms of protection planning. My anecdote about this is that when I was a director of adult social services and I went to visit the admin staff team meeting, and we had just started introducing Making Safeguarding Personal and inviting people and their relatives or advocates to meetings about them, which was unprecedented, because previously all strategy meetings or safeguarding planning meetings had very clearly been professional meetings and excluded the people who they were about. The admin staff said to me, AD, this Making Safeguarding Personal, it's fantastic because it means that the meetings are shorter, they're focused on what, and I'm putting words in their mouths, but I'm summarizing what they said. Mm. They're focused on the things that are important, and the care plans are then followed by the person because the person has been part of shaping the care plan. It's not being done to them, it's being done with them. And so that validated this as a way of practicing making safeguarding personal. So I think I've talked a bit about the statutory guidance, where it came from and why we're doing it.
Okay, so we'll stop there, and then in the next podcast we'll talk a bit more about the principles behind MSP and the practice, if that's okay with you. Thanks for that, and that's Aidy Cooper.